Welcome to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age, the show designed to help make middle age your prime time of life by defying the notion that once you reach 40, 50, or even 60 years old, your crowning achievements are all behind you. Regardless of whether you're just approaching 40 or are firmly entrenched in your middle years, it's time to launch your very own personal journey toward a joyful and purpose-filled second half of life. Each week, host Roy Richards, an expert on midlife renewal and author of A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up, will discuss the challenges common to middle age and help guide you to a brighter tomorrow. Now, here's Roy.
Well, this is the third and final program where we address you as a leader, formal or informal, in your workplace. How best can you recharge your enterprise for maximum growth and profitability in the new year? That's the question we're asking. And before introducing today's guests, let me preview one other crucial subject covered in my business leadership book, Wake Up, Captain and Crew, Restart Your Engines. It's the subject of employee empowerment without disruption and without alienation. Here's a potential model to maximize performance in your business, large and small. I call it in command but out of control leadership. You know, modern communication technology is helping to democratize businesses, large and small, in surprising ways. Well, maybe not so surprising anymore. Through the smartphone applications and laptops, you know, your frontline employee out on a sales call can access advanced product information, competitive intelligence, not to mention the big picture of where your business stands overall. He or she can receive up-to-the-minute intelligence that they never had before. The other side of the coin, of course, is that engaged employees, motivated employees, young and old, are clamoring for access to the big picture, and the accompanying they also demand participation in decision-making, which only makes sense if you know what's going on, you want to be a part of it. Your best and brightest, those upwardly mobile men and women, are asking for increased latitude to demonstrate personal initiative. And who can blame them? That's certainly something you and I want when we were on the way up. A broad dispersion of operating intelligence helps break down also traditional departmental fiefdoms. And most of us would agree that's a good thing. You know, when the accounting department is withholding information from the marketing department, or et cetera, that just leads to chaos and doesn't get anyone anywhere. Here's a question for you. As a leader of middle age who may be used to doing things the old way, how do you and I distribute meaningful decision rights to qualified frontline contributors while we retain ultimate responsibility for the bottom line? Because when all things are said and done, however the company performs, it will rest on our shoulders whether we like it or not. And, of course, we want that responsibility. A quick and simple answer to a highly complex issue. Do you want one? Well, here's one. Just run your business like a beehive. You, as the leader, can be the queen bee. In my book, I call it being in command and out of control. Now, let's say you have a highly complex common mission to coordinate, gathering pollen, making honey, building, maintaining, and operating your beehive, and you need a security force to keep away the bears. But in no way do you have the time or energy to personally direct the activities of every worker bee. After all, you're too busy laying eggs and eating your mates as queen bee. How do you encourage individual initiative while you retain arm's-length command of a revitalized, positively energized, out-of-control hive? Well, from my book, here are a few suggestions. One, disperse intelligence widely. This is just a common sense answer. Routinely advise employees how well their departments, your entire company, and your competitors are performing, and that means disperse bad news as well as good news, because acting pie in the sky like everything's great only to lower the boom later certainly doesn't empower or encourage employees to give their best. Second, grant every employee a personal franchise, be it very limited or broad, depending on the qualifications, commitment, and expand or decrease that franchise based on actual performance results. And of course, your goal is to encourage every contributor to expand his or her franchise. You want people to want more to do and more responsibility and individual initiative to accomplish it. Third, you should obtain commitment in advance for personal and collective performance goals. And that means instead of just saying, this is your assignment and I need it by tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. and do it this way and that way, you just hand out assignments in advance following a discussion and agreement that it's a fair assignment, and then you leave the employees the discretion to get it done on schedule. A fourth suggestion is to ask managers at every level to divorce themselves from everyday micromanagement. Redefine leadership if you still go to the have that old type of vision of the hands-on supervisor. That should be transformed to coach, someone who sets direction, establishes priorities, and motivates and monitors performance, but does not have hands-on every step of the way, telling employees exactly how to do this and that and exactly when it has to be done. Fifth, routinely monitor results and provide regular and constructive feedback. And I'm not just talking about the dreaded annual performance review. There, by the way, should be no big surprises in those. Discussions of performance should be two-way, non-threatening, give-and-take discussions of how to solve problems, overcome deficiencies, and none of that finger-pointing. It makes no sense to sit around and point fingers and say, why didn't you do this or why didn't you do that? The question is, how can we get the job done going forward? Six, and this is very important, establish and enforce a strict, uniform code of business conduct which guarantees absolute integrity in every transaction, internal or external. This is the one thing where there can be no flexibility. A strict moral code must be enforced throughout the organization to generate the trust going up and going down among all your employees and with your customers. And that's why we need this strict uniform code of business conduct. Seven, base rewards and promotions upon measurable individual and collective accomplishments and documented qualifications. Favoritism must be a dirty word. And of course, well, there's one exception to measurable individual and collective accomplishments. For promotion to a leadership role, you just have to factor in some soft people skills like vision, the ability to get along with, assign, and coordinate activities, and most important, to inspire others to performance. And that's something that can't always be measured based on accomplishment up to date. Sometimes the greatest individual contributor makes the worst manager. And eighth, and probably most important of all, never forget your worker bees all have personal lives, and they're not defined strictly by what they are assigned and accomplish on the job, and they deserve a full and balanced life, not just work their tails off all the time to accomplish what you want them to accomplish. An outstanding leader, therefore, lets employees define and seek their very own work-life balance and encourages that. In my book's chapter on empowerment without disruption, I go on to describe in detail a concept of economically correct leadership, which I don't have time to get into today, but I would encourage you to preview the book because that's another way to revitalize your business. And I encourage you to preview my book, Wake Up, Captain and Crew, Restart Your Engines, Recreating and Re-energizing Lagging Enterprises and Participants Midstream. And you can find it in printed or ebook form at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or at my website, www.middleagerenewal.com. And remember, if you go to our website, you can obtain a free gift. And now let's get on to the program, and we introduce our first guest. Well, our first guest today points out that 40% of Fortune 500 companies are not profitable. And I'd be willing to bet the percentage is even higher for small and mid-sized businesses, and those, of course, are the backbone of our economy. So don't feel too bad if your enterprise is lagging. You have lots of company. You know, it's kind of like the chicken and the egg. Businesses lack incentive and funding to hire and invest in growth since they're not making good profits. and then therefore unemployment remains high and raises and bonuses meager, and that discourages consumers from spending, and it goes right back to the businesses lacking incentive. It's kind of like that vicious circle, isn't it? And after 4 years of Federal Reserve quantitative easing and the infamous 2009 U.S. fiscal stimulus, we can all agree that government programs are not the answer. I don't know if Barack Obama would agree with that, but everyone else would. As a business leader, it's up to you, therefore, to find a way to recharge your business, to find solutions for profit and growth. And remember, only consumers can create cash flow for your business, and only your employees can create the value that makes the customers want to do business with you. So as a leader, it's your primary responsibility to ensure that those consumers and employees positively interact to mutual advantage, because that's really the only way you'll create profits and permit growth. And our guest is Ann C. Graham, a profit and growth accelerator. Sounds like just what we need in these days and times. She's managing director of the Legendary Value Institute and a highly successful speaker, coach, and business consultant. And her firm, Ann Graham & Associates, has been in business since the year 2000. And she's author of the new book, Solutions in Plain Sight, Transform 10 Stubborn Challenges into Profit, Passion, and Growth. Hello, Ann, and welcome to our program.
Thank you, Roy. It's a pleasure to be here this morning.
Well, in your book, you talk about the 10 biggest challenges companies face today. Please tell us what some of those challenges are.
I think I'm probably going to take us down a path where we're going to focus on the five that I think are the most critical. And let
me give
you those first.
Yeah.
The first one is around customer loyalty and retention. There has been so much research done just to prove what we all know is common sense, that it makes so much more sense to keep the customers we have today than to go out and get new customers.
Amen.
Most people are approaching that the wrong way. That's challenge number one. Challenge number two that I hear from almost every business person that I talk to is we want top-line growth. And there's a very simple formula for getting top-line growth, but once again, it's one that none of us were taught in school, and we tend to go about growth the wrong way. It's challenge number two.
What is top-line growth?
Revenue growth.
Yeah,
so in other words, when you actually bring business into your business, that's top-line revenue growth.
Yeah, that's the customers creating the cash flow that you need.
You bet, customers creating cash flow.
Okay, no, I thought that's what you meant. I just wanted to make sure everyone else...
You bet. Thanks for asking the clarifying question. What's interesting, though, is when I talk to a number of business leaders, and in the last 18 months, I've probably talked to thousands of managers, CEOs, you name it, the most prevalent issue a lot of them have is they say, you know, we're doing not so bad with that revenue and on our top line, but we have nothing to show for it at the end of the day. And that is challenge number three, is bottom line or profit growth. There's a lot of leaks that go on in between the top line
and the
bottom line, and I'll bet you your listeners are nodding and kind of smiling a little ruefully as we speak.
Yeah.
So what can we do in terms of plugging those leaks? Well, I hope we'll have a chance to share some ideas with your listeners today. The fourth really big challenge that I'm seeing a lot of people talking about is innovation and creativity.
Yeah.
We all talk about it. None of us do it. And that is really the key at the end of the day to creating the kind of value for customers that's going to set you apart from your competition, want to say, yes, we'll do business with you. So how do we make that happen the easy way?
Yep.
Last and not least, funny little story for you. I think you, every listener can probably relate to this. Most of us hate the airlines. And it's because there's a quality problem.
Yeah.
But it's not the quality problem that we all try and tackle with things like Lean and Six Sigma and total quality management. In the airlines, most times landings equal takeoffs. But it's actually the experience that we're reacting so badly to.
Yeah.
And that's challenge number five, is how do you actually deliver a great quality experience that's not just the quality of your product or your service, that's a ticket to entry these days, but how do you make it a great experience that your customers want more of?
Yeah, how can Delta get me to come back on Delta the next time when I have a choice with United?
You bet.
Of course, there's going to be less choices all the time.
And, of course, that does loop right back to our very first challenge again, which was the customer loyalty and retention. If Delta loses you this time around, good chance they won't get you back again.
Yeah, that's true, unless they're the only
The only one left standing or flying.
Where I want to go.
You bet.
Well, in your book promises surprisingly simple solutions to overcome the challenges and get your company back on track this year to growth and profitability. And we'd love to learn about some of those solutions you might have to offer for each of those challenges you mentioned.
You bet. I'd be happy to share that with you. And probably one of the best things I can do is just tell you a couple of stories of real-life people, just like our listeners out here today, who are actually doing some really good things to uncover those simple solutions and actually turn them into profit and growth. So let me tell you about Ken, because Ken is a midlife fellow, much like most of us, I would imagine, and he is a really passionate bike racer. He's very long, very lean. He's been competitively bike racing for years. He's about, close to 55 these days. Looks a whole lot younger, you would notice.
But he's jealous of his leanness, and I'm jealous of his
There you go. Well, if you just hop on a bike for, 2-3 hours a day, you'll probably be just fine on that one. Not within reach for most of us.
Sore on a bike, that's the problem. I just can't stand that sore butt.
So Ken's running a nice little company, but unfortunately he has not made a profit in 3 years.
Oh, that's rather unfortunate.
Yeah, it makes it hard to do those raises and keep those employees that you were talking about as you introduced the program today.
Yeah.
So here was the conversation that I had with Ken. We were talking about what he was currently focused on, and he was focused on something that most business leaders that I talk to, they're all in that place. They're talking about sales productivity. How do we get more of our salespeople making more sales at higher dollars to more customers? And as I was listening to Ken talk, he'd been having sales productivity conversations with his sales reps for a long time.
Yeah.
They clearly got it, but nothing was happening.
Yeah, the pressure's on, but not the solution.
Exactly. So here's what I gave to Ken as a challenge, and I want to give the same challenge to your listeners. I said, Ken, get out from behind your desk. Because all the fun in your business is on the other side. All the fun in your business and the profit is out there finding out why aren't customers buying even though you've been doing all this sales productivity work. And I'll tell you, Ken got himself one whale of a surprise. He went out and talked to a number of distributors and dealers, and the number one comment they came back with was, you're too business with.
Huh.
So think about the challenges that Ken was overlooking with that, with doing sales productivity. First of all, he was losing business, so he had a customer loyalty and retention issue.
Yeah.
Secondly, they weren't buying. He had a revenue issue. As I tell you about some of the things that were going on in his business, why he was so hard to do business with, you're going to see there were a ton of profit leaks that were definitely driving lack of profitability at the bottom end. Quality? Frankly, it sucked, if I can say that on the air. And the quality of the experience was the big issue. They're saying, we can't do business with you. We'd love to. So
well,
as Ken drilled down a little further.
A manufactured product that he was offering that was low in quality.
Exactly. His product was good, but the experience of them trying to buy from him, it turns out he had barcodes that didn't work. He had display units that you couldn't display on.
Yeah.
He had all kinds of things that were causing his customers enough grief that they were going looking to the competition to say, we need something better.
Yeah.
So here's the simple, straightforward solution. When Ken came back with all of this feedback, he basically said, all right, how do I inspire, some of my employees who've got a lot of experience in my company to help be part of the solution? Because the answers all lay within. This was not rocket science at all.
Oh, that's what I keep hammering home in my book, that you can't tear the whole thing down and start over from scratch.
No, of course not. It's simple little fixes. So bit by bit, they got what I call that sludge out of their system.
Hmm.
And here's what happened. He uncovered over $300,000 in new business opportunities just from going out and seeing half a dozen of his distributors.
Yeah.
He got the sludge out of his system, which meant that when he started selling to them again, they weren't returning orders. They weren't reworking stuff. He wasn't having to pay extra shipping charges.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, the business they were doing was much more profitable.
Yeah.
They started to enjoy the experience.
Eliminating all those, not only are you gaining customers, but you're eliminating all that not do it right the first time and have to redo it.
Exactly. And all those reworks, all that redoing, that costs a lot of money that you don't necessarily have to shell out hard dollars for, but it sure has an impact on your business and it has an impact on your employees. Nobody likes having to fix things that have gone wrong.
No, that's the least inspiring thing that an employee can do is have a customer call in and complain about something and then have to chase down a solution.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So a great little takeaway is that Ken's solution was to get out from behind his desk, listen to his customers, bring back real feedback, not his best guess that it was sales productivity that was the issue, and involve his people in being part of the solution.
One of my early warning signs in my book of deteriorating companies is increasing leadership isolation, where, you know, the top management just basically circulates among themselves and doesn't get out to customers or frontline employees to find out.
And Roy, you hit the nail on the head with that one. That is a great, great early warning sign.
Yeah, and I don't mean just saying hello at the Christmas party or the annual July picnic.
Exactly. No, all the fun is on the other side of the desk, talking to your people, talking to your customers, and doing the things that got you to go into business in the first place.
And I wonder how many leaders really recognize that the fun is really in the front line. That's
you got
where
it.
The action is. And those.
I think we all know we should be doing it. Yeah. We all get captured by everything else that's going on in our business.
Yeah, that's true. There's all kinds of overriding issues in running the company.
Exactly.
And staffing it and all those kind of things that you tend to lose sight on what's going on the front line sometimes, I think.
So here's a second little tip for your readers.
Yeah.
What Ken did is he simply made a commitment to carve out 90 minutes once a week. Now, the average business person spends 90 minutes every day just doing email. And the last time I checked, unless you're in order entry, email does not put cash flow into your business.
I'd like to get rid of a lot of my email, frankly.
So 90 minutes once a week was all it took after that initial set of visits with his customers to completely turn his business around. I think it's worth it.
Yeah, I definitely think so. But well, let's say that I'm the owner or CEO of a lagging small or mid-sized business, and my profits are down, employee morale very low, and turnover is high. Where do I begin? I guess you sort of hit the nail on the head. You begin by finding out what's going on.
You bet. And let's take it one step backwards from that, because there's something very powerful that I can talk to you and your listeners about in terms of where to start this whole process.
Yeah.
Because before Ken even went out and talked to the customers, he figured out which ones he needed to go and talk to.
Yeah.
And let me tell you a little different story here. Let me tell you about Lorraine, who is someone that I've worked with on and off for about the past 3 years or so. Now, Lorraine is a little past our midlife age. She's actually 60, and you would never know it. Again, she is an absolute dynamo. This woman sits on about 9 different boards and runs a very successful and very profitable business, but she wanted more. She's got really big plans for her business still. She's not slowing down at all.
Yeah.
So she said, okay, where do we go on this one in terms of driving more profits into my business safely, sustainably, and with integrity so that I can grow my business, bring on new staff, potentially even acquire a competitor, and really make this thing hum? What I've taught Lorraine and her team to do is a very, very simple way to figure out who your profitable customers are and who your unprofitable customers are without having to do any kind of fancy accounting.
Well, that's great.
Because one of the things we all know is that revenue is not the answer. You know, it's a great start, but there's a lot of profit leaks, as I've mentioned before.
Yeah, if you're selling a lot of widgets at dollar loss on every widget.
Exactly. If you just keep selling more widgets and you're losing a dollar on each one, pretty soon you're out of business.
Yeah.
So here's something kind of a mental image that I want you to think about, and that is all of us can tell who our dream customer is. We know what a dream customer looks like, what they act like, what kind of business we get from them.
Yeah, they just bring their checkbook along.
You bet. And we all know what our nightmare customers look like, the ones that we really just wish they'd go away. The whole process of figuring out who's profitable and who's not profitable is almost that simple. All you do is figure out, okay, what are the kinds of behaviors that make somebody more profitable or less profitable? Well, one of them is who pays their bills on time and who doesn't.
Yeah, that's for sure.
You can do that without any accounting whatsoever, because people will have a good gut feel to say, yeah, customer A, they always pay on time. Customer B, we're always putting them in collections.
Yeah.
One's more profitable, one's less profitable. If you come up with about 5 or 6 different questions like that, another good one is, who's really difficult to get along with? who's easy to get along with.
Yeah, and there again, you're talking to your frontline people and you're finding those kind of things out.
They know this stuff. They know it right off the top of their head.
And if you show interest in them and by communicating not just as the big boss, but as somebody that is on top of the situation and wants to find a solution, I'm sure they'll be glad to share that kind of information.
Exactly. But here's the real kicker on this one, Roy, is that when you actually engage your people in having those conversations and you sort of build out a little list, it can just be on a whiteboard, it doesn't have to be anything fancy,
yeah.
And people see who are the most profitable customers and who are the least profitable and who are somewhere in the middle,
yeah.
Behaviors start to change overnight.
Yeah, they would, because then the salespeople want their commissions to go up, so they're obviously going to concentrate on the more profitable.
Exactly. Your internal people are going to stop over-servicing or bending over backwards for customers that are costing you money. And also, sometimes it's really small customers that are just easy to get along with that are very profitable. We often ignore those customers.
That's true.
Sometimes going through this exercise, you're like, wow, they're our bread and butter. We better step up the pace a little bit.
Yeah, I was a wholesale insurance broker, and we had a lot of insurance agents that only maybe give us $5,000 in premium a year. But, you know, they were low-maintenance type producers, and they could be very profitable because those $5,000 policies add up.
Exactly. They all add up. And when you actually get a sense of saying, you know, what you just described is that, gee, these kinds of customers are very, very profitable, you can also direct your salespeople to go find more like them.
Yeah.
Once you have that very clear sense of our ideal customers who are profitable, they're out there. You just have to go find them.
Well, as an initial stage in your legendary value cycle, you talk about creation of competitive advantage that's impossible to duplicate.
Yeah.
And that sounds wonderful. But right now, we're just, I'm in my company and my theoretical company, we're just struggling to keep up. How do I out-innovate competitors with the people and resources that I currently have on board?
I am going to give you such a simple answer on that one. It goes back to a little bit of the story I told you about Ken in terms of getting out and talking to his customers. That's where you need to go first.
Yeah.
But I want you to hold your right hand up in front of you, and I want you to spread your fingers pretty broadly.
Okay,
and I want
I'm
you to kick off
that, but
five things. If you're driving, don't try this at home.
No.
But get the mental image of those five fingers.
Yeah.
When you're listening to your customers and you're talking to them about their business and about what's keeping them up at night and what's, you know, what are the things that are really driving them crazy, you just have to listen for five things. One is, how can you save them time?
Yeah, everyone has that question.
Exactly, because none of us have enough time. If you can save them time that your competitors aren't doing, they probably will never even know you've done that, because unlike a product innovation, they can't just send it to China and copy it.
Yeah.
Saving someone time is an emotional value as opposed to a product value.
Amen.
It makes a huge difference. That's finger number one.
Yeah.
Finger number two that you want to listen for is, can we save or make them money? Again, if you come up with something, and I can give you examples all day long, which we may not have time for in today's show, but certainly there's a lot of examples in the book, Solutions in Plain Sight. But if you actually figure out how to save them time or make them money. Again, you're not changing your product. You're not investing in R&D. You're not doing any of those things that cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
But you're differentiating from what your competition is doing.
Yeah, because your competition isn't asking those questions.
Exactly. Finger number three is, can you solve a real problem? This one, I'll give you a quick little example just so people start to get the mental image.
Yeah.
I was working with a ball bearing company. I mean, there's nothing more boring and undifferentiated than a ball bearing, right? Just a little hunk of metal. Not very exciting.
Yeah.
But when this company went out and talked to their customers, they found that they were actually using the ball bearings to fix plant equipment. And that those fixes typically needed a bunch of other bits and pieces and parts. So they'd run around the warehouse. They'd pick up all these bits and pieces. They'd see if they were out of stock on one of them, and if that was the case, they had to defer the repair till later.
Yeah.
So what this ball bearing company did is they basically said, we're going to put together a little kit.
Oh.
And it wasn't any much more exciting than getting the equivalent of a Ziploc bag, sticking the ball bearing and everything else that was required in that little kit. Now, what did they just do? They saved the company time. running all over the warehouse to find the bits and pieces.
And I would immediately, if I were a customer, I would go to that ball bearing manufacturer instead of the competition.
You got
get
it.
That little kit.
You got it, because they saved them money. All of a sudden, if they had a piece of plant equipment that was down, they had everything they needed to get that plant equipment right back up and going again.
Yeah.
They solved the real problem, which was not that we want to buy your bearings. We want to buy a solution to the problem we just had with our plant equipment.
Yeah.
They gave them a solution.
Yeah,
simple
you're selling a solution to problems, not just a product.
So on those first three fingers, you've saved time, you've saved money, you've solved a real problem.
Yeah.
Here's where we get into some fun stuff. The fourth finger is give people peace of mind. You said you were in the insurance business. What were you selling, Roy, in the insurance business?
Peace of mind, basically.
You got it. So it doesn't have to be insurance, but think about if you're the supplier that always delivers on time.
Yeah.
No, does that give you peace of mind?
For sure.
Absolutely. What if you always get the order right the first time rather than them having to phone and say something's missing, something's wrong, we need to send something back?
Amen.
Is that peace of mind?
I'll be back.
You got it.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's finger number four, is anything that you can do around peace of mind is very, very high value and differentiates you from your competition, because most of them are making mistakes all the time.
Yeah.
Okay. Finger number five is create a feel-good. And let me tell you a quick little story just from personal experience this week. I'm sure that, like me, all of you and your listeners hate your wireless provider, your cell phone company. Well, I had a situation this week where I phoned my cell phone company. I was expecting the usual really long wait. You know, your call is important to us, but please wait for the next 40 minutes for an operator.
Sounds like my cable company.
I actually had my cell phone connected to them, and I took another call and put them on hold. When I came back, the phone line was dead. And about 30 seconds later, my cell phone rang, and it was the cell phone company saying, you were trying to reach us. How can we help you?
And it was a live person.
It was a real live person with no time on hold whatsoever. I said to her, you have just created a wow in my day, because it's something I never expected. So when you think about creating a feel-good, what did that person do? Just by being responsive to my needs? By surprising me in a way that I hadn't expected? So look for those little surprises.
Yeah.
Those are five simple ways to innovate in a way that differentiates you from your competition without any big R&D expenditure, without any big product redevelopment or redesign or prototypes or any of those kinds of things. It works in the service industry. It works in the product industry. It works in big companies, and it works in small companies.
Well, you've got me convinced, but here's one more million-dollar question.
How do
I filter that down to the employees within my organization, especially the midlife employees who have been doing something some way, the same way for years? How do I transform them from old-style conformists into new economy thinkers?
Well, you know, it's almost the same way that Ken did in his company. Here's what I've done before with organizations, and I've seen it work like a charm. You do a little lunch and learn once every week, once every couple of weeks. And there's actually, in the book Solutions in Plain Sight, there's actually 21 different paths to the kind of innovation I just described. Oh. They still all hit one of those 5 points. But this group that I'm going to give you this example of, every single week for 21 weeks, the company bought them lunch.
Oh.
They sat around the table, brainstormed one of the 21 ideas, and said, how can we use that idea to save time, save money, solve a real problem, give them peace of mind, or make them feel good?
And you know, the great thing about that is you're not threatening when you do that. When a company comes up and the CEO says, we're going to change the way we do business.
Exactly. You guys are wrong.
And everyone then crosses their arms over their chest and sits back stubbornly. But if you have a little problem, we're going to solve one little problem each week, and you get a free lunch in the process.
Exactly, free lunch and the chance to use your creativity. What else do you need in terms of saying, hey, I want to be part of this.
Yeah,
I want to be part of the solution. I want to save my job.
You reward people for being creative, maybe not in money, but obviously they get recognition from their peers. And it really, I would think, would encourage what I like to call circles of cooperation.
Exactly. You nailed it again, Roy.
You can even get that beyond the corporation by including your suppliers and your customers and, cooperating with them in some way through that interaction that you're talking about.
So exactly. There's so many doors that open up just when you start getting out from behind your desk, going and having the conversation, engaging your customers, engaging your employees, and by all means, extending that to your suppliers as well, why not? It makes perfect sense.
Yeah, and let's tell people about your website. There's just tons of valuable information on there. And how does someone find out about your book or go to your website to learn about your consulting services and your online interactive services and all the other good stuff you offer?
You bet. Well, I'll give you the website address first, and then I'll give it to you again just in case that you haven't had a chance to grab a pencil.
Yeah.
But the website is www.legendaryvalue, all one big word,
yeah.
legendaryvalue.com.
That's pretty easy to remember.
Yeah, pretty easy to remember.
And don't forget, this is the Internet, so you can go back and listen again if you didn't get it.
There you go. And when your listeners go to the site, there's actually a free assessment tool that they can get access to. There's a bunch of free resources. The website is going to be going under redevelopment for the next probably 2-3 weeks.
Uh-oh.
And by the end of March, the book will be up on there, and there'll be a whole new slew of some free training videos, some free resources that will really get people pointed in the right direction. So if anyone wants to go to the site today and actually take the free assessment, that will let me know that they've heard this show. And then when the new website comes out, I can always prompt them to say, hey, there's some great cool stuff on here.
Yeah,
why don't
actually,
you come on back and get some value add?
You know, this show, I think, will debut around March 11th. So that may be a little early for your new site, but, you know, you can go back and try it again later.
You bet. I would say go to Legendary Value on April 1st.
Okay.
And you'll be good to go.
Even though that is April Fool's.
I do indeed. And there won't be any foolishness on the site, just some great resources.
And once again, that website is www.legendaryvalue.com. All one word, easy to remember.
You got it, Roy.
And I would highly recommend that because I spent three hours just perusing all the information on there.
Well, I thank you for taking the time to do that. It's great to have that endorsement.
Yeah, and thank you so much for joining us. I think you've been very helpful, and everyone really in our audience is a leader. You may not have a formal title in your organization, but given these kind of interaction that Anne is talking about, you can certainly participate and hopefully generate some new ideas either as an informal leader or formally in your post as a leader in your company or your business or your enterprise, whatever it may be. And we can all get our businesses renewed and back on track as we start the new year. And thank you so much for joining us today, Anne.
My pleasure, Roy, and I hope that leaders at all levels step up and focus on profit and growth.
I hope so, too. Thank you so much.
Have a great day.
Well, it's time for our ongoing weekly feature where we introduce websites of interest to large numbers of our middle-aged listeners. And today we introduce you to ClarkCollegeFunding.com. As we move into spring, decision time approaches for your teenage son or daughter who are getting ready for college, their seniors, and for you. And the most important thing to avoid is to have your son or daughter accepted to a college of, quote, her dreams or his dreams, and then find out with financial aid that this school offers you just can't afford for your son or daughter to go there. And our guest today says the startling average cost of college education today is $38,400 per year, but that's the retail sticker price, and he has a system that can save you $40,000 to $60,000 per child on the total cost of college, so you can pay the wholesale price. And I know that that's possible because I know we have a prestigious college here in Iowa named Grinnell College, where the retail cost of tuition and room and board is over $50,000 a year, but according to the local newspaper, only 10% of current students pay that full amount. Our guest is Ryan Clark. He's founder and CEO of Clark College Funding, Inc. He's a certified college planner and frequently lectures at high schools and professional groups, and he's also author of the book College Aid for Middle Class America, Solutions to Paying Wholesale versus Retail. And I just wish my wife, Lori, and I had had access to Ryan's website and book before our two children went off to school a few years ago. Hello, Ryan, and welcome to our program.
Hey, Roy, how are you?
Well, in visiting your website, I was very impressed with your approach to deciding on why your teenager wants to go to college and then deciding on where to apply. We don't have a whole lot of time, but can you summarize the process?
Sure, sure. What we've done is we develop a step-by-step process for parents and students to eliminate the confusion and tell them exactly what needs to be done and to give them an understanding of what goes on behind closed doors with the colleges and to teach them the new rules, if you will, the new regulations to how to play this game. Because when they went to college, the process was completely different and colleges were looking at things completely different. But now today, with the use of computers, colleges have gotten really, really sophisticated. And so we need to kind of counterbalance that as a parent to really get a fair shake, to try to get any aid from these schools.
I know when my wife and I years ago went to this college planning night at the local high school where our kids attended, I was just intimidated and totally confused, you know, about all these forms they described and everything I needed to do, like right now. And I just wish I'd had access to a system like what you describe. But I think it's very interesting you have the students define what they really want out of their college before they start looking at those colleges. And then you, I guess you're able to provide a list of colleges that can meet their expectations or what they're looking for so that they're not just like shooting in the dark.
Yeah, we call that the funnel approach, where we try to find out what son and daughter, mom and dad are looking for in a college.
Yeah.
And we use that criteria and we start out with 4,500 plus colleges and universities in North America, and we just funnel through those and eliminate all the colleges that just don't fit what mom and dad and son and daughter are looking for in a college.
And
then from there,
they sort of have to agree in terms of the parents
versus
the child, what they want.
Because it can be different. What mom and dad's looking for and what son and daughter's looking for can be completely different.
Well, what are some of the biggest mistakes that parents make in planning for a college and how to pay for it, and how can they avoid some of those mistakes?
Sure. Well, number one, we were talking about narrowing down the schools. We want to apply to 6 to 10 schools. I think some students and parents don't apply to enough schools or apply to too many schools. And out of those 6 to 10, we want some in-state public schools on our list, as well as some private schools. And the private schools can be from anywhere.
Yeah.
And we do that because we want to create some competition between those schools.
Yeah.
So when we're narrowing down those schools and that funnel approach, we want to find schools, 6 to 10 schools, where not only it's a good fit, but it's also a good fit academically, socially, and financially. And that's the piece that a lot of parents and students don't think about, and
yeah, they
should.
Think all about the ideal college, and then afterwards they try to, after the child is accepted, they try to figure out how they're going to pay for it.
That's right.
And then
they
go to that college and don't have any other options, and that's where you can end up in a real mess, I would think.
That's right. And another huge mistake parents and students make is they don't wait until they get all the information before they commit to a particular school. So I teach with the parents I work with to wait until you get the financial aid award letter in the spring of the senior year before you commit to any school.
Yeah.
Because that's when you're going to know exactly how much it's going to cost to go to that school.
And I would think it would probably be good to get that letter from more than one school so you can basically create some competition.
create competition, see how much it's going to cost before we commit. And like you said, most students and parents, they commit fairly early in the process, usually November, December, January, as soon as the student is accepted, and that's the wrong thing to do. You have until May 1st to commit to a school.
Oh, I see.
So we have plenty of time.
Well, say my son or daughter has only average grades, or his or her SATs aren't outstanding. He or she's not a star athlete or class president, and she doesn't know how to play an instrument very well. How can I make colleges want to recruit my son or daughter that will give me some leverage in negotiating for some aid and discounts?
Yeah, that's a great question. What I tell my students, the key to this is to find colleges that are looking for your son and daughter, and vice versa, colleges, your son and daughter that's looking for your daughter as well. What I mean by that is not all colleges are looking for the same type of student.
Yeah.
So DePaul University outside of Chicago, you know, they like to recruit students from working class families, first generation college students,
huh.
Right? But Caltech or MIT is really looking for students that are very, very good in math and science.
Yeah.
So Caltech is not looking for the same student as DePaul, and DePaul is not looking for the same student as Grinnell.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
So what we need to do is find 6 to 10 of those that are a good fit for your son and daughter.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, tell us about your interactive programs that are available on your website and also about your book, because I'd love to know, you know, how the listeners can obtain the kind of information that you're describing and how they can get these lists of colleges and narrow them down and all that.
Sure, absolutely. And I'll offer all of your listeners a free 30-minute consultation. They can just go to my website, just put in your name, their information, let me know if you'd like that free consultation. I'll be glad to sit down and answer any questions that you might have if it has to do with college. I'll be glad to. You can certainly get the book at Barnes & Noble's, also at Amazon.com, or from my website. And if you buy it from me and my website, I'll actually sign it for you and put it in the mail for you as well.
Yeah, that's such a great subject because there's so many people, you know, they don't really qualify. They have too much money, supposedly, for need aid. And yet, without a major sacrifice, they just can't afford to. Like you say, it's like buying a new car each year for 4 years. And if you have two college-age children like we did going to school together, then it's really a problem.
It's such a huge burden today with college so expensive. And like you said, middle-class Americans are really getting squeezed. And they just make too much money to get the need-based aid, and they don't make enough money where paying for college is going to be easy, especially when you have two in college at the same time.
But your book then offers a number of possibilities and things they should consider to get some aid that isn't strictly need-based, and also hopefully how to avoid going so deeply in debt that you're paying off your college for your son and daughter, or they themselves are paying it off for years and years.
That's exactly right. Where college can be an asset, but sometimes college can be a liability as well. We make the wrong choices. And we're leaving college with a degree, but it's going to cost, you know, $200,000 of debt. And we're only making $18,000 a year, then college has become a liability.
Even worse, you have some cases, I suspect, where parents take out a loan and then their child drops out of college and they're still stuck with a loan. And we don't want that, obviously. Well, our program is debuting on the Internet in late March. And if my son or daughter is graduating this spring, is it too late to implement your methods for the college entry this fall, or what should I do then if I'm kind of late in the game?
Late in the game, it's almost too late for this year, but there might be a way for next year during their sophomore, junior, or senior year where you can implement some strategies.
Yeah.
But really the best bet is for any parent that has a child who's a current junior or sophomore or freshman. And that way we can teach them up front, because you want to do a lot of this work up front so you can get the results that you expect.
Yeah, definitely. It should be done early. And that's why I would encourage everyone to go to your website and give them that address again so that they can check it out.
Sure. You can go to ClarkCollegeFunding.com or CollegeAidForMiddleClass.com.
Yeah, those are very valuable websites. Now, my kids are through college, so not too worried about it myself, but for anyone that is in that situation, I would highly recommend that website. And thank you so much, Ryan, for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age, hosted by Roy Richards, an expert on midlife renewal and author of both A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up, and Wake Up, Captain and Crew, Restart Your Engines. You can learn more about Roy and his Middle Age Renewal Training System by visiting his website, middleagerenewal.com.